I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Getting corporate CEOs involved in civic affairs can be a challenge. Globalization, mergers, consolidations, and franchising conspire to keep the attention of top business leaders focused anywhere but in their own hometowns. But the commitment today's guests have to their local communities runs counter to the larger trend. Cliff Hudson is chairman and CEO of Sonic, the company headquartered in Oklahoma City that franchises its drive-in restaurants around the country. But Cliff also holds the title of chairman of the Oklahoma City School Board. He'll compare the experience of running a major business with running a major school system today on Smart City. Carl Gardino has the job of leading CEO involvement in the public affairs of Silicon Valley. His members are among the leading technology companies in the world. So what are they doing involved in housing, transportation, and education in the Valley? We'll find out today on Smart City, right after the news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Clifford Hudson has spent the last 21 years of his career at Sonic Corporation, an Oklahoma City-based publicly held company that owns, operates, and franchises Sonic drive-in restaurants. He is chairman of the board, CEO, and president of the public company with 3,000 franchised and company-operated drive-in restaurants. He also serves as chairman of the Oklahoma City School Board, a position created in 2000 as part of a $530 million turnaround of a 40,000-student inner-city Oklahoma City public school system. Cliff, what possessed you as chairman and CEO of Sonic to run for chairman of the Oklahoma City School Board?
Well, the background for this whole endeavor, the actual running for the chairman of the school board was coincidental to another process. I'm a product of the Oklahoma City public schools, and like a lot of school districts across the country, had watched it decline over the decades. And was involved from, say, 99 forward, was involved in a community effort to attempt to turn around the school district. And as part of that community effort, the law was actually changed so there would be a four-year term chairman of the school board. And the mayor of our city asked me to run for it late in this turnaround plan process. So really the willingness to run for the school board came as part of a several hundred million dollar turnaround plan. Otherwise, I don't think I'd ever would have done it.
What was central to the turnaround plan?
Well, there was a number of things that came into that and I think made it work. First of all, a really kind of a cross-functional grouping of folks throughout the community. Our labor unions, our professional groups related to education, our business community, nonpartisan, bipartisan, political community, a whole series of folks representing different segments of the community coming together in a voluntary way to kind of put together a turnaround plan. And I think that was core to making the whole thing work. In addition to this cross-section of the community, we did have almost a two-year process of putting together this plan, a review of every single building, all the physical facilities, meetings across the district with probably 3,000 patrons once you put all the meeting attendees together. And so a considerable process for building support for this and ultimately putting together a turnaround plan. So I think that kind of wide engagement was critical to both putting together a good plan, but building community support in the process.
What if you had lost? Do you think that would have compromised in any way your credibility at Sonic or with your employees?
Well, I guess, I don't know. That's not something I necessarily thought about. As a matter of fact, I think the engagement and the selling to my own board of directors was the concern about winning, not the concern about losing. My board might have been happy had I lost in the process. But the fact is that, as it turned out, with the mayor asking me to do this, and I co-chaired the campaign with the mayor for the dollars from our taxpayers and so on. When I filed to stand for this position, it was a newly created, statutorily created position that had previously not existed. When I filed for it, no one else filed, and so on the one hand, you can say, one hand, you make that stands a reason why would anyone else file. But at the same time, it did make that easier because I didn't have the risk ultimately of losing once no one else filed.
As school board chair, what are your responsibilities?
The responsibilities, first and foremost, and on a broad basis, are the successful implementation of this turnaround program that our patrons put together. This was called, a program was called MAPS for Kids, and that comes from a MAPS program we'd had earlier, which was an acronym for Metropolitan Area Projects that focused on the cultural life in the district. And once we are successful implementing that, about $350 million in the core part of Oklahoma City focused on cultural life, once we were well into that, this is where our patron said, well, if we could do MAPS for cultural life, we could do MAPS for kids, which would be focused on education. So my primary responsibility, first and foremost, is the successful implementation of that, rebuilding, renovating all of the schools and building five new ones, replacing all of the transportation that was outdated, technological infrastructure. They have fiber optic wiring for all of the schools, all teachers having access to laptops, desktops, et cetera, throughout the schools. So the physical rebuilding of it, and then restructuring of the administration, new financial team, better reporting systems. So the response to Master Kids was my first responsibility, and it goes beyond that then to the more mundane, ordinary course of business activities too.
We've seen school districts like Kansas City build fabulous new facilities, and I'm all for that because I do think the place you work, if you will, or the place you reside 8 hours a day makes a big difference in how you perform. On the other hand, we've also found that building new buildings and doing the kinds of things you're talking about, or we're not necessarily seeing the evidence of improvement in the classroom or among students. What has been your experience in Oklahoma City?
Well, I think your point about if your focus is on the buildings, it's not going to turn it around. I think you're exactly right. Kansas City, not only with the focus on the buildings, but my impression is it was also a court-ordered process. In Oklahoma City, it was a patron-driven process. And so there was ownership of the plan, the turnaround plan, at the point that the voters voted on it. Kansas City court-ordered, Oklahoma City patron-driven, and approved by 61% of the voters when the vote occurred. So a completely different process, but we also had elements of our plan. It wasn't just about buildings. It was about getting fiscal integrity to the management of the school district, about focusing on academic performance of the school district, about a different kind of leadership or governance structure, thus instead of having this rotating president that the board had had for 100 years. Instead, we have a four-year chairman, four-year term for a chairman that stays in that leadership position. So there were a number of areas of focus different than you would find in a place like Kansas City where the court orders renovation or construction. But in terms of the soul of the district, the community doesn't engage in the same way.
What are the biggest differences you've found in running a public school system and running a public company?
Well, it is a different job, and in many ways it's a tougher job. You know, in the private sector, you can more easily, I think, in many ways, get resources allocated to be aligned with agreed upon strategies and reward people in a different way. Ours is a public company. Every employee of our company has stock options. I'm sure every officer of our company, their single biggest asset is stock in our company. So people get highly incentivized to help make things work, and they're rewarded for making things work. The public education situation is quite a bit different. It has different history, a different culture, different compensation. You've got teacher unions, which, at least in the case of our business, we don't have. And you've got intensely regulated environment, state regulation, federal regulation. You've got continuous unfunded mandates that both the federal and the state government pass down. It's a much more difficult operating environment. In addition to that, to a great degree in my own company, I can choose the resources I want to work with to a very considerable degree. I don't choose my customers. I hope all customers, everyone wants to be a customer, but I can choose most of the resources I work with. in the school district, the primary thing you're going to churn out is an educated child and a well-educated child ready to be a good citizen. But the school district, a public school district, can't select that product. It's got to take what's brought to them from the community. And particularly in urban school districts, this is a tremendous challenge because of the degree of poverty and the lack of preparation that the kids have when they start school and the lack of support they have often in a home environment. So those are some of the biggest differences. There are some similarities, but those are some of the biggest differences. And the public situation is a much bigger challenge.
People often say government should run more like a business. You run both. Does that statement have any resonance with you now?
Well, I think that I read something a few years ago that I thought was pretty good point on just that point. I think it's difficult, the point of a moment ago about the fact you can't choose your resources in the public sector, in particular education, like you can in the private sector. I think where the point makes sense, though, about running it like a business is that the public sector can be run in a more business-like manner. It doesn't mean you can run it like a business necessarily, but certainly in terms of setting goals and benchmarks, and certainly in terms of setting in place measurement systems, and in terms of selling people on moving a consistent direction and going back and measuring and then putting in place resources like technology or testing processes or coaching processes for people, doing these types of things that you would do in the private sector. If those are brought to bear in an education setting, you can produce better results in a surprisingly quick fashion if you have that kind of narrowed focus and alignment of resources. The private sector, I think, has been used to that for a long, long time if it's a well-run company. The public sector, I don't think, has been accustomed to that. We've done that in the last several years in Oklahoma City and gotten some fairly rapid improvement from an academic standpoint, though we're a long way from where we need to be.
And what stands in the way of being where you need to be?
Well, I think a lot of it, unfortunately, is just time. When you start working with children who came to school unprepared, may well not have had, in our case in Oklahoma City, the core part of this district, though there are probably 125,000 kids in school in the city, there are only 38,000 in our core school district. The other kids are in suburban schools, et cetera. The biggest challenge is many of these kids, 86% of our kids are on a free or reduced lunch program, which is one definition of poverty on a federal level. So when these kids come in, many of them come in much less well prepared. They may have little or no preschool, and they show up for kindergarten or first grade well behind where many of their counterparts across the community come in. So as we may have had years of kids that are frankly ill prepared, coming in and supplying new systems and new approaches literally just takes years to try to start building literacy, numeracy, building. Even with your teachers, use of technology in the classroom, use of new methods for alignment of resources. So we've had big jumps, but the challenge is the sustained effect of those efforts. And so you get 5 and 7 years down the road, and what you start seeing is higher test scores in the middle school. You get 5, 7, 9 years down the road, and what you start seeing is higher graduation rates. But the problem with this is if you start these processes, the kids that are 12 and 13 years old when you start them, you don't necessarily see graduation rates jump that much, 2 years after starting these kind of approaches.
And that then frustrates the public who are paying for schools. How do you give them confidence that you're on the right track, that the money they're investing is paying off?
Yeah, I think you have to continually communicate with them, with the public, about that you are being good stewards with their money, and you can find pockets of success for doing that. On the first thing we did, because it was the first area against which we could move, was when we bought buses, we heavily advertised the fact that we had bought the buses, so the money was being spent as we told them it would be spent. As we renovated one school, the next school, a lot of community public relations about the completion of that school. So there are progressive things you can do along the way. In our case, before I became chairman of the board, we had 10 consecutive years of qualified, meaning not clean, audit opinions, and we now just recently reported our fourth consecutive year of clean audit opinions. So as you do those types of things, you get the word out to the public that you're handling their money differently, that you're being more a better steward with the money. So I think when in doing that, I wouldn't say you buy time. I would say you build confidence that you're doing the right thing, and you get goodwill with your voters over time. We, in fact, have seen that in terms of public perception of the quality of the work within the school district.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Cliff Hudson. He's chairman and CEO of Sonic Corporation and chairman of the Oklahoma City School Board. Is more money part of the solution? We often hear that. Is more money part of the solution to education improvement?
Well, I do think it's fair to say that money alone is not the solution, that if you don't run school districts, to use your term earlier, in a more business-like manner, if there's not a focus on outcomes and measurement systems and alignment of resources and higher expectations, if these things, if we look at a poor school district and we say, you're not going to achieve it there, let's have lower expectations, you're going to get lower expectations. So money alone won't do it. You do have to shift expectations and processes and the talent that's applied. At the same time, I do think money is a huge, huge factor. When our society is willing to spend two and three and sometimes even four times on the average prisoner in a prison system for what we will spend on our average child and preparing them in public education, you cannot expect to get what we need out of public education when we have that kind of ratio. So I do think that more resources are going to be necessary in our country, not just because of the challenges of public education, but because the world's changing rapidly, our country and its economy is changing rapidly. We have shifted from a manufacturing-based economy to an information-based, knowledge-based service economy. And if we believe we can raise our children the same way we did it 20 and 30 years ago, and what was okay then is okay now, we're in for a big shock.
But people still believe that, don't you think?
I do think people believe that because they'll often go back and say it was good enough for me, it's mm-hmm. good enough for you or our kids now, it should work. But I think different methods have to be used, and most importantly, we are a much wealthier society than we were 30 or 40 years ago, and we've got to think about education in a different way in order to prepare kids for a 21st century workforce.
I'm curious, you run Sonic, great product, by the way, you employ a lot of young people, I'm sure, as your frontline workers. How do you think about your frontline workers and how they come to you, the talent pool you have to select from, what they need to be prepared to do, how schools need to prepare them to move up? Is this job good enough? Could your frontline workers create more value for you? I'm just curious how you connect those two parts of your life, educating students and hiring so many frontline entry-level workers?
Well, I think about it a couple of ways. One, in terms of the connection between the two, I think about education as being a base or a foundation for creating opportunity for people. In our society today, with the nature of the economy, if a child doesn't have an effective education, doesn't finish school, and particularly doesn't finish high school, doesn't go into college, their earnings potential and nature of their work experience is going to be fundamentally different throughout their lives. So the education piece does help create opportunity for children throughout their lives. In our case, as a franchisor of a 50-year-old restaurant concept, we view ourselves as working to continue to that opportunity creation more in the sense of creating opportunity for small business operators mm-hmm. who want to build their own business, have a large business base, large contracts to buy off of, marketing arrangements, et cetera, so they can operate a small business but compete in a much larger environment. But to your specific question about how do we see the frontline worker, frankly, most of the young people we employ, we are their first introduction to a free enterprise system, to a kind of a market-driven economy. We're the first introduction to a formal setting where customer service, you know, makes all the difference. So when you're employing 16, 17, 18-year-olds, I think we're looking at a different circumstance somewhat than society may be looking at altogether. But the direct parallel, I think, in terms of introducing 16 and 17-year-olds in our circumstance for what it means in our economy more broadly is that they are joining us. They are joining a service business. I mean, it is a food service, restaurant service, but they are interacting with the customers, learning to deliver what the customer wants, smile, interact with the customer, and the rewards for them can be quite real. And whatever job the person goes into, whether staying in our business, becoming a partner of ours and operating a drive-in, or becoming a franchisee and a multi-unit operator, whatever path they go into, that initial preparation and introduction into a service business can be very meaningful. My first job as a 16-year-old was working in a restaurant. And I can see a lot of comparisons of what I was doing then in terms of interacting with the public to comparison to what I do now.
Has your experience on the school board taught you anything that you found useful in running Sonic?
Yeah, I think I'd have to say that the experience has really been somewhat the other way around. That is, the experience I've had with Sonic has helped me in terms of building plan and process in the public setting. But there probably have been fewer things coming the reverse way. I would have to say the experience I've had in the public setting helps me appreciate the quality of resources that I have in the private sector and the quality of team that I have here and the teamwork that we have. So it's taught me to appreciate that much more than I might have before I engaged in the public arena.
Mm-hmm. When your CEO colleagues ask you about your experience sharing the school board in the public sector, what do you tell them? The toughest part of the job is what?
Well, the toughest part of the job is working to keep forces aligned towards common objectives, because oftentimes people don't think in terms of outcomes in that public arena, and they don't think in terms of common strategies. They often think more just in terms of differing interests. And in the private sector, I think it is depending upon the size of your company, it's easier to try to sell on a common vision and then align resources than it is in the public sector.
Mm-hmm.
But the discussion in terms of the management aspect probably focuses on that. But usually, if I'm sharing this in a setting with folks from the private sector, I share more with them the overall turnaround plan that we've put together, the $512 million approved city sales tax and bond proposals, real estate taxes backing those bonds. I usually spend more time talking about the total turnaround plan than the management aspects.
And what's been the most rewarding part of this job as school board chair?
Well, in some ways, the rewarding thing is in the public setting is similar to the private sector setting, being in a CEO's position, and that is staying engaged long enough and necessarily in a successful manner to be able to see the consequences of your planning and your implementation. In the private sector, there's no doubt that that's true. A lot of the stuff is tough day to day, and it's hard to find things that are necessarily rewarding day to day, but over time, the performance of the company, the change in your brand, the career development of individuals, very gratifying. The same thing's true in the public sector. It's often difficult to get satisfaction day to day, but over a 2, 4, 6 year period, seeing some real fundamental changes in fiscal integrity, in physical facilities, transportation for these kids, use of technology, improved financial reporting, improved academic results. This is how you get your satisfaction, as a very deferred gratification basis.
One more quick question. When your CEO colleagues ask you what can they do to help improve public education, what do you tell them?
Well, my suggestion to them is to get engaged at the local level. I think in a lot of ways we have looked and mistakenly, we've looked to state and federal authorities to try to solve these things. Some of the resources brought to us by things like No Child Left Behind, they are really serious incremental resources, and that has been enormously helpful. But the fact is that these are our children and these are our communities, and I think engagement at that ground level is essential in order to improve public education across our country.
And when you say engagement, obviously you are deeply engaged. You ran for office, you won, you're running the school board. So for someone who doesn't have quite that level of commitment, what do you recommend they do?
If someone has very limited time and doesn't plan to engage in a systemic sort of way, tutoring a child can be huge. There is plenty of evidence that sustained tutoring of a child by the same person, going to an elementary school, reading with a child once or twice a week, that doing that on a single year basis can help a child advance in a reading schools and reading skills. In essence, 2 years in 1 year, one school year. They start third grade, they're only reading at a second grade level. You can help them catch up by the end of their third grade year so they are reading completely at third grade level. So doing as little as tutoring a child can be huge in improving a child's circumstance in life.
Cliff, I appreciate your service, and I appreciate you talking with us on Smart City.
Happy to do so, Carol. Appreciate the opportunity.
Cliff Hudson is chairman and CEO of Sonic Corporation and chairman of the Oklahoma City School Board. You're listening to Smart City. The latest news in the world of urban planning, design, and development comes to us from Plan Edison assistant editor Nate Berg.
It's no mystery that cities like business. More business means more economic activity, means more revenue. So oftentimes, cities prime the pump by offering tax incentives and subsidies to businesses and developers to attract big money retail projects. But state legislators in Arizona are looking to put an end to this practice. According to an article in the Wall Street Journal, Phoenix and Scottsdale have at times resorted to outright bidding wars to lure big developments. The lawmakers want to stop this use of public money and are proposing a $1 loss of state funding for every dollar cities spend subsidizing retail developments. Proponents of the bill hope its passage will cut down on the amount of revenue lost to cushy tax incentives. But many worry that without these incentives, retailers will take their business elsewhere, and the cities will see an even greater loss of revenue. And while some cities are thinking about their economic growth, a number of U.S. cities are dealing with a huge population growth. Recently released census figures show that the metropolitan Atlanta region has experienced the most growth in the nation. The region's population increased by more than 890,000 people in the last 6 years. The city of Atlanta now has more than 5 million people, making it the 9th largest city in the U.S. But along with the growth has come some negative effects, like longer average commute times and an increased strain on the region's school systems. However, the growth is expected to continue in Atlanta as long as housing remains more affordable than many other parts of the country. One type of home you're sure to find in Atlanta, or in Boise, or in Orlando, or practically any American city is the ranch style. The sprawling ranch-style home became hugely popular in middle-class America after World War II. While today many might look back on these homes as retro throwbacks to another less sophisticated time, preservationists in Chicago have petitioned the city to halt one homeowner from tearing down a recently purchased 1950s ranch home. The Chicago Tribune reports that a group of concerned citizens has campaigned to save this and a number of other ranch-style homes in order to protect their historic value. The dumbfounded homeowner called the move, quote, ridiculous. But with his original plans for demolition thrown out the window, the only thing the not-so-proud homeowner can do is move in to his newly historic home. For Plan Edison, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is assistant editor for PlanEdison.com. After a short break, we'll continue our conversation on CEOs who are reshaping their communities with Carl Gardino on his work with tech executives in Silicon Valley. Smart City is made possible by the generous support of Memphis Urban Innovators, a collaboration of Memphis business leaders, including the Memphis Tourism Foundation, who are focused on bringing smart people, smart ideas, and smart solutions to Memphis in the new economy. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Carl Gardino is president and CEO of the Silicon Valley Leadership Group, a public policy trade association that represents more than 200 employers who collectively provide one of every four jobs in Silicon Valley. Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger just appointed Carl to a four-year term on the California Transportation Commission. In 2000, the San Jose Mercury News named him one of the five most powerful people in Silicon Valley in its once-per-decade study. Carl, you represent Silicon Valley companies, the companies we think of as the most cutting edge. What are the issues that concern them today?
As we poll Silicon Valley CEOs, we hear consistent themes. The top issues impacting the success of cutting edge companies in Silicon Valley are issues like affordable homes, a quality transportation system, a great education system, affordable and accessible health care. In an innovation economy, it's about the people so that those talented people are available, productive, and can then develop the product that is in such demand around the globe.
How will growing concerns about the impact of free trade on American workers affect your members?
As our members look at a global economy, what we hear consistently is, obviously, for sound business reasons, these companies need to be located with facilities, people, and products around the globe. That's for reasons from supply chain, raw materials, access to customers, access to talent, etc. What we try to do as an organization is to make sure that we have sound public policy, whether that's locally, regionally, state, or federal level, so that the reasons why companies may be located around the globe are for those sound business reasons and not because of competitive disadvantages based on policy decisions that have been made or haven't been made. So we want to make sure we stay competitive as a country so that we can keep the jobs that should be here to stay here.
I want to explore the intersection between the offshoring of jobs or simply starting new facilities in other countries and the things that you feel need to be provided to make Silicon Valley competitive from a public policy standpoint, affordable housing, healthcare, transit, great education. You've traveled to India, I'm sure. A number of your companies, of course, are growing jobs in that country. Transportation is a nightmare. How do you reconcile the need to provide a level of service in this country, and specifically in Silicon Valley, to satisfy companies, and yet those same companies are growing jobs in other countries that don't provide anything nearly as competitive from a quality of life standpoint? Talk me through that.
Happy to do so, and an excellent question as well, Carol. Let's first address the term that you used about offshoring. It's amazing as you drive up the streets in Silicon Valley, you're going to pass companies with names like Hitachi, Fujitsu, SAP, Rome, and numerous others. These are all foreign companies in America employing American workers and prospering our economy. So whenever we use terms like offshoring, we have to also remember the tremendous amount of jobs in Silicon Valley and across America that are the product of onshoring, as those foreign companies also want to have access to customers, supply chains, etc., that are located here. So from a policy perspective, we have to be very careful of the boomerang effect of anything that we do that would close our borders or try to limit expansion or trade, etc., has a way of creeping back and boomerang hitting us right back in the forehead. Second point, from a policy perspective, high tech in Silicon Valley loses more jobs to the state of Texas than we do to China and India combined. So as we look at being competitive, even as a region or a state, our competition isn't just global for those jobs and facilities. We need to be much more competitive just with other states in the United States.
When you lose jobs to Texas, do you mean that they pick up and leave Silicon Valley to go to Texas, or do you mean that jobs are created in Texas that you feel should have been created in Silicon Valley because those companies have a presence there?
Thank you, Carol. Companies rarely move lock, stock, and barrel, pulling up literally often hundreds of millions or even billions of dollars of infrastructure investment and leave any region or state, let alone Silicon Valley in California. What happens all too often is as companies grow or even stay the size they are, we unfortunately in Silicon Valley lose a lot of jobs, and many companies, certainly none that I would put on the spot, have an exit California strategy just from a competitiveness perspective. But we still have some tremendous challenges, and they're primarily around two issues. The cost of living for our workers, and our workers are by far our most precious commodity, and the cost of doing business in the United States, but also in California as opposed to the other 49 states.
I want to give you a chance to exit the gloom and doom for a minute and the challenges and talk about what makes Silicon Valley this magical place that most of us think about in terms of generating new ideas, new jobs, and new businesses. Let's talk about what it is that makes Silicon Valley so legendary.
We have tremendous strengths here, and I'm sure many regions do and celebrate theirs as well. First, we are home to more than 7,000 high-tech firms and more than 1,000 life science firms. So when we look at driving industries, we have an incredibly diversified high-tech life science as well as financial services base. And it's not just one cluster of high-tech or of life science. It's across the board. There's not a region in the world that can rival that type of cluster depth and diversity. Second, we have some of the finest world-class universities in the world. The Economist magazine, the last two Septembers in a row, has ranked the top 20 universities in the world. Three of them are in Silicon Valley or the Bay Area. That's unrivaled. Why is that important? If students study here, they're much more likely to stay here, join companies here, form their own companies here, and contribute greatly to our economy. Third, our workforce against the national average is 2.5 times more productive, and that is a wonderful strength, especially when you're a high-cost area, as you try to balance out those costs. Productivity truly helps. So those three are very important, but a fourth one that I just have to mention is venture capital funding. In fact, when you look at the 12 top high-tech, life science, or financial service regions in the United States, more venture capital investment happens here for Silicon Valley companies than the other 11 top tech regions combined. So for a number of reasons that we celebrate and try to grow, this continues to be unparalleled, the top high-tech life science region in the world.
Let's come back and talk about cost of living for workers, cost of doing business. You said those are the two biggest threats that Silicon Valley faces in terms of continuing its vitality. Surely you don't mean that you feel that Silicon Valley has to be the cheapest or cheap. I mean, at what level, Carl, do you need to be able to compete in terms of the cost of living and the cost of doing business? What makes you competitive? What's your target?
In Silicon Valley's history, which is only about six decades long, we have never been the low-cost center. We will never be the low-cost center. So our strengths have to be on some of those other areas that I've mentioned in terms of productivity and what we create here in the innovation economy that we enjoy. But in terms of those challenges, they're very real. when a worker wants to be part of the Silicon Valley economy but literally cannot afford a place to live, whether that's a for sale home or a rental, or if it means living here but commuting 2-3 hours each way each day, that's not a sustainable economy for that worker or for these companies that are competing so much for those gifted workers. So let me just give you some examples of how challenging it is here. In terms of home costs, the median-priced resale home in how we define Silicon Valley is hovering near $800,000. To put that in perspective, if everyone in the Valley, every family was shopping for that first home today, that less than 15 out of every 100 families could afford that median-priced resale home. I'm going to put a finer point on it. Two top computer makers in the world, HP and Dell. HP currently number one, based here in Palo Alto, California, and Dell, of course, based outside of Austin in a community called Round Rock, Texas. The median-priced resale home in Palo Alto, where HP is headquartered, is $1.6 million. In Round Rock, Texas, that same home is $180,000. So when those two highly competitive companies are trying to lure the best and brightest engineers out of college, when a home is 12% in one community as it is to the others, that makes it a tougher sell.
And so how do businesses involve themselves or influence public policy around the issue of affordable housing? And in this case, affordability is not for low to moderate income people. Affordable housing, as you say, is how do you get an $800,000 house down to, what, half that? Or
what we've learned is we have to be both strategic and tactical when we tackle issues. First, Silicon Valley, to its credit, has a history of not whining about challenges but trying to find a way of winning. And when it comes to homes that working families can afford, and that's not just the bright, young, talented people that we're constantly trying to bring to our companies, but everyone else who forms the fabric of Silicon Valley that is also integral to its success. There have been some interesting solutions that have been offered that have literally positively impacted thousands of families.
Silicon Valley is so well known for invention and innovation. I'm curious, have you worked at all on the product side of affordable housing? In other words, it sounds as if you've worked on the financing side, but I'm curious, have you looked at all at how to bring the cost of housing down from a product standpoint, not a subsidy standpoint or not a financing standpoint, but actually from the product itself?
We are not home builders, nor does the Silicon Valley Leadership Group represent home builders. Fine people, we partner with them often, but because we so often advocate for the communities that they are trying to build, we don't think it would be appropriate for us to actually have them as members. But to directly answer your question, what we try to stress with home builders is that there is a market demand, and we've been able to show this through very quantifiable survey data of technology workers for something other than what too many people view as the home that everyone wants, which of course is the huge home on a huge lot. And in fact, when we're talking about trying to build up a rail transit system and make very smart use of a very limited land supply, when we can have more compact development, both for sale as well as rental homes, just the fact that it's more compact can make those homes less expensive. And let me put a fine point on that. A residential acre of dirt in Silicon Valley today is about $3 million an acre. Now, historically, we have about 7 homes per acre. Doing the math, that's nearly $300,000 per home just for the dirt before you stick a single stake in the ground. Remember that home in Round Rock, Texas? $180,000 completely built. Our dirt, $300,000 a home. So if we can have slightly more compact development, better use of our dwindling land supply, reduces the cost of the home to the consumer, better for rail transit to deal with our traffic congestion issues and air quality issues, and we build a better community in the process.
In fact, it seems that with your survey work, you actually have influenced the housing product, its cost, and then its price, by simply providing data to home builders that then suggest to them there's a different product, there's a market for a different product out there. When you think about business involving itself in issues of affordable housing for its workers, healthcare for its workers, transit for its workers, it seems as if this is a different agenda for business than, say, the agenda you might have seen 20 years ago. Would you agree?
Well, the agenda is really one of enlightened self-interest. What can we do to stay competitive, to make sure that we recruit and retain the world's top talent that drives an innovation agenda and allows us to be competitive and successful in such a fast-paced world marketplace? And when David Packard, the co-founder of Hewlett-Packard, formed the leadership group 29 years ago, that was his attitude. As a matter of fact, when he was asked why he formed the group, his quote was as follows: "Our job as CEOs is not to sit on the sidelines and either cheer or jeer. Our job is to get into the game and move the ball forward." And he wanted a group that was as proactive and positive and progressive as he and the company that he co-founded and co-built was.
And Carl, if you looked back 29 years ago when David Packard created your organization, would the agenda look similar? I mean, I'm trying to understand really how business involvement and investment in community has changed, or has it?
Well, what's fascinating is it has and it hasn't. Let me, when Dave, a quick story about David Packard. Early on in his career, he was giving, he was part of a conference on wartime production, and this is in his book, The HP Way. So this is way back in the 1940s. Very young man at a conference with hundreds of other CEOs. He stood up, and this was his comment: "We need to care as much about our communities, our employees, and our customers as we do our shareholders." Second, so many of our CEOs are engineers, and what do engineers like to do? They like to solve problems, and that is a great attitude for this valley, not only to invent, but to invest in what we need to do as communities to be successful.
Carl Gardino is president and CEO of the Silicon Valley Leadership Group. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. One thing every major city has is a busy airport or two. City View's commentator Walker Smith has a favorite place in those airports, no matter what city he's in.
The best place to escape the stressful crush and crowding in a busy airport is not a bar or a shop or an airline club. It's the Interfaith Chapel. Usually tucked away down a seldom-used corridor, little known to and little used by other travelers, the Interfaith Chapel is my secret refuge in airports all over the country. The chapel is always a small, quiet, softly lighted place to sit and meditate or read. Each chapel is variously furnished and stocked with spiritual readings. Religion per se is a low-key element, no doubt because the chapel must accommodate people of many faiths. But this understatement works to great effect. It creates a hushed, soothing atmosphere of peace and tranquility that is barely disturbed by the periodic arrival and departure of the few other people who come in to take a moment to rest or pray. Usually, I stay longer than most, leaving at the last possible moment to catch my flight. I don't do any work when I'm in one of these chapels. Rather, I catch my breath and recharge my batteries so that I will be ready for work when it's time to go. This is no different than the sort of break other travelers are trying to take in airport bars and shops and clubs, but I find those places to be just as crowded and stressful as the concourses and gates. The only place that truly provides me with a respite to regroup is the one place in the airport where religion and spirituality intersect with business and commerce. As we spend an ever greater portion of our lives at the office, our need to ensure some balance at work rises as well. Religion and spirituality are the root source for much of the balance we want to create in our lives. Hence, it's no surprise that we see an increasingly visible presence of religion in the workplace. Suddenly, it's okay to discuss God at work. As many as 10,000 prayer groups meet regularly in workplaces all over the country, and over 80 conferences are held each year on spirituality in the workplace, up from only one just a few years ago. Both Business Week and Fortune have featured cover stories on the growing confluence of religion and the workplace. Religious groups come to where people are, and the office is where more and more of us are, more and more of the time. As we pursue our selfish economic interest in marketplace transactions, many people find that the selflessness at the core of religion keeps them connected to the broader meanings and purposes of what they do and provides them with deeper satisfactions in their lives. The desire for this kind of balance is one reason for the popularity of the new bumper sticker that reads, "Real success is ending up in heaven." For many people, the conjunction of work and religion facilitates the balance they need. Just as for me, on a smaller scale, the interfaith chapels in the airports where I spend so much of my time offer me a chance to find focus and renewal as I make my way through the complexities and demands of the business day. But the need is not so much for a place of worship as it is for any place apart where people can find balance, perspective, and renewal. People need a place to slow down as much as they need a way to get around. Yet our communities don't always take this into account. Planners focus mostly on the activities people do in an effort to maximize the volume and efficiency of throughput. Airports, too, are built to move passengers along with maximum speed and efficiency. Finding a place to step off the people mover is not easy. The Interfaith Chapel is the only place I've found that provides a genuine escape. Similarly, the gardens and chapels of urban churches are often the only shelter available to get away from the push and pull of city sidewalks. Churches serve us well with the nooks and crannies that give us a place to pause, but our community should too. Because to keep pace with life today, we need time out to catch our breath. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities, a national network of urban leaders whose next national meeting is May 1st and 2nd in San Jose to discuss turning urban amenities into urban assets. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.